this week's 51%, we hear from a woman who supplies pro bono attorneys to low-income women who are victims of domestic violence.
Many people don't really realize the civil court is available to them, especially victims of domestic violence.
We meet a woman who teaches skills to deaf children through education and theater, and we bring you two very different stories about proms, from Montana to Ireland. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
My name is Luca. I live on the second floor. I live upstairs from you. Yes, I think you've seen me before. If you hear something late at night, some kind of troublesome kind of fight, just don't ask me what it was. Just don't ask me.
For women being subjected to domestic violence, getting help doesn't mean just calling the police. Oftentimes, they can gain protection from civil court proceedings, but many cannot afford a lawyer. An organization called Her Justice works to fill that gap, supplying lawyers to domestic violence victims who are often poor. Executive Director Amy Barish, who headed the New York State Office for the Prevention of Domestic Violence from 2007 to 2012, spoke with 51%'s Ian Pickus.
Her Justice is a not-for-profit in New York City. We've been around for a little over 22 years. And our aim is really to ensure that low-income women in crisis get legal representation. As you probably know, there's a real gap in access to justice in the country, but in New York State as well. And we bridge that gap by providing low-income women with pro bono attorneys. So our attorneys handle a lot of their cases in family, divorce, and immigration court. But about 80% of the representation is actually done by volunteers from the law firms in New York City. You know, we have more lawyers per capita in New York City than almost anywhere else in the world. And yet 80% of the litigants in family court don't have a lawyer. So we try to bridge that gap and put the power of the private attorneys behind our low-income clients.
You have a background in government work. Was that where you started to recognize the extent of this problem?
I do have a background in government work. I've actually had a background in a couple different areas, all of which led me to Her Justice. So I was pretty recently the executive director of the New York State Office for the Prevention of Domestic Violence here in Albany. And we focused on making sure that victims of domestic violence around the state got the response that they needed. Prior to that, I was an attorney in private practice. I was an attorney in public interest practice. I've worked for New York City government. So I've really been on all sides of this issue. I have myself represented victims of domestic violence in family court and in Supreme Court. And I took that experience when I came to the state to try to understand how could systems be more responsive to victims. Now I'm back down in the city, kind of putting all of that experience together, bringing the private sector in to fill a gap with my knowledge of how policy works, with my knowledge of how the victims, what the victims need when they go to court, and thinking in terms of systems, how can we find a systemic solution to making sure that people get the representation that they need?
Is there ever reticence on the part of someone who might benefit from having a lawyer in the courtroom with them to have representation, to reach out to your organization? I mean, how do you get paired up with these pro bono attorneys and the people who might benefit from their presence?
Yeah, what I think happens is less reticence and more that there are a lot of people who don't even know the law can help them. So the way we get lawyers is in New York City, there's something called a Family Justice Center. And we have a couple of these around the state. There's one in Buffalo. There's one in Westchester. We have one in every county, every borough in New York City. These are sort of one-stop shops for domestic violence victims. So if you have a criminal case pending, you'll know about the center, but you can also go there without a criminal case, maybe to get advocacy services, to meet with a police officer, to meet with a therapist. Most of our referrals come either from those centers or from the courthouses themselves. Our number is given to the family court, so if somebody comes in and needs representation, they can call us. But I think a big challenge is that many people don't really realize the civil court is available to them, especially victims of domestic violence. When most of us think domestic violence, we think call the police. And that may be a perfectly good solution, but it's not the only solution. People can go to family court and get orders of protection in the same way that they might in criminal court, but they can also get things like decisions about child support, custody, and visitation that the criminal court can't give them. So one of the things we're trying to do more of is community outreach and education to let people know that there is this family court that can serve as a resource to people, especially if they're not interested in calling the police. Probably only about half of domestic violence is reported to the police, maybe less than that. So we want to make sure that everybody who's in danger knows there is a legal remedy available to them that doesn't necessarily require calling the police.
Why is domestic violence such a stubborn problem to get a handle on? I mean, we're talking victim services here, so after these acts have already been committed. But what about stamping out the problem in the home before, you know, before it gets to a courtroom?
Absolutely. Well, I don't know how long your show is. So to give you really the answer of, you know, why is it a stubborn problem, might take longer than we have. But you raise a really good point. But I think it's actually another reason why the civil court is important. You can go to civil court before there's been an arrest. So, and the standard of proof, to sound lawyerly for a second, the standard of proof in family court is lower. So let's say, for example, you have a power and control dynamic in a household that's starting to escalate, where there's name calling, maybe there's been some shoving, sort of lower level, what we would consider to be lower level domestic violence in the home. The criminal law is not going to be able to do a lot with that. But you could go to family court and get an order of protection. And for many people, that actually reduces the violence. And there have been studies that have also shown that for victims of domestic violence, when they go to civil court like that, bring their own case and get an order of protection, it makes it more likely that they'll take other safety-seeking measures. Because victims of domestic violence are often, they're really controlled by their partners. Their access to outside information and affirmation is very limited. So their partners may be saying to them, no one's going to believe you, you don't deserve anything better than this, this is all your life is ever going to look like. To go to court in front of a judge and have a judge say to the victim, you're right, he's wrong, he has to stop his behavior, it's very empowering for someone. So it can serve a kind of preventive function, as you're saying, because it intervenes a bit earlier in the process and may give her the power, both because of the order of protection, but just the emotional and psychological power to go forward and do other things she may need to do to get safe.
Speaking of, if someone's listening to this segment and knows someone in this situation or is in this situation herself, what should she do?
It's a great question, and it's very hard to know what to do. I would say the number one rule is not to judge and to listen, because there isn't one right answer. As I mentioned, a lot of victims don't call the police. And while the police have been trained to respond and there's a terrific criminal justice response available, it's not the right response for everybody. And I think it's important people know that there are options. So if you have a friend who's in trouble, or if, you know, one of your listeners is in trouble, there are hotlines everywhere across the state to just, you can call anonymously and get information. The most important thing is people know what their options are. So you can call anonymously to find out where to get advocacy in your community, where the courts are. And if you're talking to a friend, just listen, support them, and ask them what they're trying to achieve, and probably encourage them to call a hotline. Because if you're not a domestic violence expert, you're not an expert, you're a friend. And so what you can do is be supportive and support the choices that your friend is making. And really, unless you're sitting, you know, walking in their shoes, you don't know what they're experiencing. So it's very hard. It's, you know, not helpful to judge, but just to be a listening ear and let them know there's support and resources out there for them.
We know traditionally public defender's offices have been underfunded by and large. And I know this year your organization has reached out for state support for the first time. How do you fund an operation like this? And, you know, are you in a struggle to get these lawyers to the people who need them?
Absolutely. Well, I'm the head of a not-for-profit, so of course we're always struggling for more resources.
Right. Well, you're talking on public radio.
Exactly. One of the reasons our solution, I think, is really interesting is that we're actually very cost-effective. We leverage this private sector volunteerism. Lawyers are supposed to be doing pro bono efforts, and we connect them with the people who need lawyers. So we have a 17-person legal staff, and we leverage, you know, the work from 70 law firms in the city, which means we can represent over 4,500 people a year. So it's a very efficient model that works well in cities where there are so many lawyers, like New York City. New York State has been a real leader in providing access to justice, and there has been an increase in the funding to legal services, which is terrific. We will need more funding for legal services. What we try to do is be a complement to legal services, because if 80% of the people in family court don't have lawyers, that's an enormous cost to try to get a lawyer to all of those people. If we can match what legal services is doing with volunteer attorneys, we can get much closer to making sure that everybody is getting the legal information and representation they need. So we are able to find the private attorneys. What we need is more resources to support our office, the lawyers and the paralegals who provide the support and do the matching, because it is such an efficient model. You know, with one attorney, we're actually leveraging several hundred other attorneys and therefore representing over 1,000 clients.
That was Her Justice Executive Director Amy Barish speaking with 51%'s Ian Pickus. And this week, we bring you another installment of the 51% segment called Force of Nature from Dr. Sharon Ufberg. She is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in Napa Valley, California. She regularly blogs for the Huffington Post, and this week she interviews Dr. Michelle Christie, who is founder and executive director of the Los Angeles-based nonprofit organization No Limits, which began in 1996 to help underserved and economically disadvantaged children with hearing loss gain the skills to succeed in school and life through its national theater program and after-school educational centers. Christie talks about why addressing this group of children is important to her.
I think since I've been a young child, I've always been interested in communication. I was extremely shy, a young girl growing up, and didn't speak very much. And I tend to be more of an observer. And as I learned about language and how you develop language, the idea of not being able to hear as a child just really would disconnect you to the world. And so I was always fascinated by that. And then I started learning sign language. And with that, it seemed like it was a perfect connection to start a theater program to help deaf children develop the confidence and the speaking skills to do well in life and connect to the world, and also let the audience see how much work it is to learn how to communicate, but also their capabilities, and that all of these kids have the ability to go to college and do well in life, but they need the resources to do that.
So do you find that they have limited resources and so, in fact, aren't able to succeed at the same level as hearing children?
Yes, and that's been the statistic nationwide, but also here in California, over 80% of children with hearing loss are functioning at a fourth grade level by the time they hit 12th grade. So fourth grade, and that's considered functionally illiterate. They're not able to really read and write and be part of the world. Yet the resources that we're able to provide here at No Limits, 100% of all of our kids go to college and graduate from college. So it's possible. It's just that the school system doesn't provide all that these children need, and parents tend to have to fight for just some of the littlest things to get their children the services that they need.
So can you just give me an example exactly how does No Limits help children with hearing loss?
Absolutely. You know, No Limits, I'm a teacher of the deaf. I graduated from the USC program through John Tracy Clinic, and I got my doctorate in education. And so when I started working with these kids, I realized right away that if you had the resources, if you could provide the private therapy, you could afford it and do it three times a week, and your kids will probably be okay. But for the families that were disadvantaged economically or living in poverty, those families weren't getting those resources outside of the school. So No Limits kind of comes in and provides individual auditory speech and language therapy. We provide an hour of literacy twice a week. We provide parent education. We also have embedded a STEAM program, which is science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. So all of these kids are getting the services that they are not receiving enough at school, and we're kind of filling in all the gaps. And then we're also creating a college-going culture here to let the kids know what they're capable of doing. No Limits is all about I can do it, so teaching the kids that they can do it. And also for parents, this is the same for my family. I came from poverty as well and a single mother, and my mom didn't graduate from high school. And so for her, she didn't know about college. And so we can take that parent education weekly classes and teach the parents what they can do to help their child succeed as well and work with them at home and let their children know that they can go to college and be the first generation. So it's a really beautiful process to watch because you know when the kids come to No Limits that they're going to do well.
What's the national theater program that you also have?
That's how it all started. I have a theater background, so when I started the nonprofit, it was just a theater program. I was concerned about the kids over their summer. There was no services at all for them, and I thought, oh, gosh, we've been working so hard all year to help them, and then in the summer, they may lose all that language that they developed. So I decided with a friend of mine to write a play, and so we put on an original production in 1996 with eight kids of eight families trusted me with their kids, and we went out there and did a play, and these kids were amazing. And then it was kind of funny, is right after the show, someone said, when's your next one? And I was like, oh, I guess I'm going to have to do this again. So we started doing more and more, and now we're over 100 productions nationwide. And what's so exciting is the kids have performed at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., and this year we got asked by Carnegie Hall to come and do another show that they're all original called Silent No More. So on December 15th, our kids will be performing there this year, which is really exciting because we're changing history and letting people know that these kids have the capability to do anything that they dream to do.
So what's your next dream for No Limits?
Oh, geez, it sounds like the most craziest dream, but I would love that one day, you know, overall that kids don't have to come to an after-school program like No Limits and they could just go out and play with their friends and have the language and get all the services that they need at school. So my dream, my ultimate dream is to be able just to provide these services so I can see the kids, but eventually not have to do that. That would be my ultimate dream. But next for No Limits is just continually opening new centers. We got so fortunate to open a center in Las Vegas, and we just opened one in Oxnard, California. And there's so many other kids across the country that need these educational services. And so we'd like to continue to open more and franchise the program.
Thank you so much, Michelle Christie from No Limits for Deaf Children. This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Now we meet an entrepreneurial Montana woman who turns her small farm town into a mecca for prom dresses, drawing high school girls from all over Montana and as far as North Dakota and parts of Canada.
You're listening to Mountain West Voices. I'm Clay Scott. Conrad is a farm town of about 2,500 people on the windswept plains of northern Montana, just east of the Rocky Mountain front. Most people in this area raise wheat or cattle. Bonnie Poser makes her living selling prom dresses.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Bonnie's business is called The In Thing, and she's been selling prom dresses out of this shop for 40 years.
We do the big ball gowns. We do the semi-balls. We do chiffons. We do fit and flares. We do sequin.
This time of year, carloads of girls and their parents descend upon Conrad to shop for prom dresses. They come from all over Montana and beyond. Bonnie's had van loads of high school girls from North Dakota, 11 hours away. This year, she found dresses for triplets from Vancouver, British Columbia, and countless customers make the trek from Alberta and Saskatchewan.
Mainly, we give service. Number two, we have inventory. And number three, we're half the price. And that's just the way the ball bounces.
Bonnie asks me to remove my shoes, and she leads me to the back of her shop where hundreds of dresses hang from racks, with no two the same.
Dresses take on a personality. And color makes a difference, and style makes a difference. And just because you see it in the picture doesn't mean you really, that's for your body type or your personality. So I encourage them to come and try. Our girls are in the dressing room about 2.5 hours.
All of her dresses come from China, and they sell for about $500, some a bit more, some less.
This is a ball gown, and all the beautiful colors in it. You have kind of a lime under color and a blue teal over tulle with all the jewels and the embellishment. It's just a yummy dress. Now we'll get girls in that say, I don't want any jewels. I want it plain. There are girls like that. And then these are chiffons. And chiffons are jeweled at the top and then they have a real free-flowing bottom. And there are girls that this is most comfortable on them. Generally, with prom, you want to be Cinderella at least once in your life.
Bonnie says she won't sell the same dress to two girls at the same prom, or grad as it's called in Canada. To make sure that doesn't happen, she keeps meticulous records in pencil. There are notes taped everywhere.
I don't do computer. No, everything is done the old-fashioned way and the long way. Mm-hmm.
Only once in 40 years, Bonnie says, did she sell the same model dress to two girls at the same school. When she discovered her mistake, she says she drove 5 hours to the girls' town with a carload of dresses.
When you're looking for a grad dress or a prom dress, none of the rest matters. this girl wants to be a queen for a day, and that's our job. And we don't care what size she is, we don't care what color she is, we don't care what her nationality is. We're here to make her feel like a princess. I was raised on a farm ranch operation at Power, Montana, and I graduated from Power in 1963. And yes, we had proms, and they were important, just as important as they are today.
What did you wear for your prom?
It was a strapless peach. Girls haven't changed much. We're all the same, you know. Just, I don't think I was any different than these girls. They're just excited and giggly and want to look beautiful, and that never changes.
Just imagine if I held you in my arms. Just imagine if I held your wonderful charm.
You've been listening to Mountain West Voices. Our series is produced in association with the O'Connor Center for the Rocky Mountain West, a regional studies and public education program of the University of Montana. Additional support was provided by the Greater Montana Foundation. To see images from today's program or to listen to and download more stories from around the Rocky Mountain West, go to mountainwestvoices.org. I'm Clay Scott.
On a honeymoon for two, that's far as my imagination will go.
And now as prom season concludes for some and is around the corner for others, we're going to revisit a story, a mother-daughter prom story, called Who Took Mom to the Prom?
A dress, makeup, hair extensions.
This is my 18-year-old daughter, Kathleen.
Getting your hair curled and all.
Slap bang in the middle of prom fever.
Nails.
Spray tan.
I borrowed a dress from a friend.
If you've ever lived with someone going to a prom, you'll know that all that talk about hair products and
strapless
dresses can wear a bit thin.
Low back.
So I was giving her the deaf ear. Until she mentioned how she got invited.
He said that he wasn't sure who he was going to bring. I said, well, bring your sister, bring your cousin, bring someone, just go. Bring me if you need to. And then he was like, well, I mean, I could bring you. And I said, yeah, you could.
It reminded me of a prom I went to when I was her age. I'd had a phone call from this guy I knew. He was kind of serious and shy, but nice. And the phone call went on and on until the penny dropped and I realised he was working himself up to ask me. So I did what Kathleen did and said, I'll go with you. Well, that was a long time ago, about 34 years ago, in fact. And it was in Cork City, right at the other end of Ireland, long way away from where we live now. What happened next? Oh, yeah, it's the night before the dance.
Louis is a boy in my course.
Kathleen is chit-chatting at the dinner table about this boy who's bringing her to the prom.
First time I met Louis.
She says his name is O'Halloran. And I say, that's so funny, the guy I was telling you about, his name was O'Halloran. And she says, well, it couldn't be the same. This guy lives here in Dublin. And his dad's name is Connell.
Well, that was the most ridiculous thing I've
ever heard. Connell. Connell. That's the name of my guy. And then there's loads of high-pitched shrieking and oh my gods, and laughter and all. I found a photo of me at 18.
It's one of those old kind of sepia-esque photos.
Got her to send it to the boy who was inviting her and to ask him to show it to his dad.
Ask him if he knows someone by the name of Emer Horgan. Get yourself a cup of tea while you're at it.
It was the same guy.
I was gobsmacked.
Your son, my daughter, in a different city, bump into each other and unknowing. Yeah, bump into each other and do the same thing.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking.
And no, before you say it, there's no fairy tale ending. We didn't fall in love second time round. And the kids didn't fall in love. Not yet, anyway.
Who Took Mom to the Prom was produced by Emer Horgan for the Third Coast Festival's 2015 Short Docs Challenge. She is also the mom in the piece. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. Percent is spelled out. This week's show is number 1401.